violent naturalism and radical naturalism, and I'll mention this one second. Naturalism. This is the theory that every aspect of human existence or experience can be accounted for in terms of man's existence as an intelligent animal. Okay, well, according to this definition, which I don't think is completely all-inclusive, one of the characteristics that we can maintain about naturalism. Naturalism, in its most general sense, applies to the concept that denies any existence of reality transcending the natural realm. Okay. You mentioned the idea about the laws of science themselves. Okay, and radical. We're going to talk about radical naturalism. Let me give you a definition and I'll try to explain this. Radical naturalism is completely negative concerning the possibility that a higher meaning can be derived from the laws of nature. Radical naturalism is often defined as materialism. I'll repeat this. Radical naturalism is completely negative concerning the possibility that a higher meaning can be derived from the laws of nature. Radical naturalism is often defined as materialism. When we think of materialism, I think one of the best examples is the economy. Everything operates in the material order. There's nothing at all transcendent, nothing at all possible above the actual laws of nature themselves. Everything is alive, everything is seen in terms of process. We have a cause in the beginning of the process, and you go from event to event in the process. Okay, but there's a different side to naturalism. There are those that hold a little bit different view of naturalism, and this is what I term moderate naturalism. Moderate naturalists feel that even though all reality is temporal and spatial, there can still be infinite value from nature itself on the features. Moderate naturalists feel that even though all reality is temporal and spatial, there can still come some infinite value from nature itself. Okay, what they're saying is, like, take the concept of beauty. I'm saying if you look at the laws of nature itself, if you look out the window, you can get some concept of value in the processes of the laws of science themselves. It's not just a process through which we're going through. It's not just something that goes from cause to event, from cause to event. It's not something just that operates on a straight line according to the laws of process of nature. We're saying there's something infinitely more in nature itself. But this too is not transcendent. It doesn't come from out here. It's temporal. It's something coming from the laws themselves. Many naturalists of this type would say that there's a possibility of value being present. There's a possibility of beauty being present. There's a possibility of actual consciousness being present. This means that man's operating on this level of natural process actually has the ability to think and comprehend of what's taking place in the process itself. And naturalists of this type can see something taking place in the natural process that they would actually term God himself. What they're saying is there's something in the natural process that allows man to progressively move along. But it's not the same concept that we have as the Christian faith as a transcendent God coming from out here and actually influencing our world. He's coming from here and being active with us. It's something that comes out of the natural process itself. So this is very different. Does this answer your question, or do you feel that...
Yeah,
it's delineated.
It looks like a dinosaur.
Okay, let's turn to some more of the positive terms we talked about. I think in the last period, I can't remember, but somebody asked a question about combining pantheism and theism. Or was this pantheism and deism? I can't remember. It's the person here that asked this question. So I think this is very important. I could not think of the term to save my life. But when we combine deism and pantheism, we come up with what is called panentheism, and I'd like to talk about this for a few minutes. Let me give you a definition. Panentheism. Okay. Panentheism. Just put an N between pan and theism and you have it. Okay. Pantheism combines deism and pantheism. This is a belief that God is identical with nature in one aspect of his being, but he transcends nature in another aspect of his being. That's how it is. Pantheism combines deism and pantheism. This is a belief that God is identical with nature in one aspect of his being, but he transcends nature in another aspect of his being. Okay, last time we asked somebody to mention the possibility that we have possibly that theism and pantheism can be combined. In a minute I'll give you an example and show you what the difference is. I got a quote from John Hick, I think, who partially explains this definition. He says, just as a person is both the sum of all his experience and parts, and just as a person is both the sum of all his experience and parts, and yet more than they are, so God has all a finite being as part of his being and experience to transcend it. What we actually have in pantheism, we're saying here, we define deism. We talk about deism. This is the idea that God up here came down to the world here, created it, and left the world completely alone. The world was left to operate on its own. That's what deism is saying. But what a pantheist is actually saying is that this God is transcendent here, actually comes to the level of the world. And in the natural process that takes place, there are elements of God's consciousness that was here, that was up here for the deist, actually left in the process. In other words, in the process that takes place here, on the natural level, we can see the actual transcendent God that has left the world. What the panentheist is doing, he's trying to take the two stricter terms of pantheism and deism and combine them and get a God that will better explain man's existence or the process of man's existence. Okay, let me talk about quasi-theism and give you a definition of this. This is a concept of combining the aspects of theism and pantheism to solve the problem of evil, but yet to keep a God worthy of worship. This is the concept of combining the aspects of theism and pantheism to solve the problem of evil, but yet to keep God a God worthy of worship. Now let me explain what statement was here.
Do you repeat that term?
Okay. Quasi-theism. Q-A-S-I. Then you have a hyphen. Theism. Quasi-theism.
Solving the problem of evil and then doing work.
And still at the same time keeping a God that's worthy of worship. Okay.
Ask you a question about pantheism.
Okay.
On the part of God that's equal to nature, would that be just man? Would that be man and nature, or what?
Well, with a pan, okay, we're combining pantheism, okay. What a panentheist is saying that not with just man, but he's trying to hold a stricter level for nature itself and the natural process. He's saying God is in everything. But actually, all you have to do is look at your world, and you can see God coming through. But at the same time, he's saying that God is a part of this world, too. God is still transcendent. What would be an advantage of that? The world, if you look at the world around us, we see, even though it's a wonderful process, the world seems to still have the possibility of having problems. It's not completely perfect. This comes through with man's problem of evil. But what would be the advantage of being able to be transcendent? If God is transcendent, that means that God still has the possibility of coming to the world, bringing something from the outside to solve the problems here. And as we talk about quasi-theism, we're going to see where this is a big flaw, where God actually becomes finite when he comes to a level of man down in the world. When God, by actually becoming involved with man, loses this possibility of bringing something other from the outside to solve his lawful being. And I'll repeat this definition one more time. Quasi-theism, this is the concept of combining the aspects of theism and pantheism to solve problems of evil, and yet to keep God worthy of worship. In a few minutes, I'm going to note five characteristics that the quasi-theist holds in his concept of God. But before I do this, let me give you an example of an individual that is a quasi-theist. This is E.S. Brightman, Edgar Sheffield Brightman. Okay, when we talk about the problem of evil, I mean, believe the other day a question was asked concerning a theistic concept of God. Can we take the monotheistic concept of God, or even go one step farther? Can we take the Christian Orthodox term or definition of God and say that it's a theistic argument? Yes, we can. But with the word perfect, if you remember when we defined the theistic argument, everything hinged on the idea of one unified, perfect God. But for the Christian, for the Orthodox Christian, he even goes farther, and he has certain other aspects of what it means to be perfect. He qualifies that by saying that God is all-knowing, he's all-perfect, and he's all-present. And that means that we can do away with the mere possibilities that aren't joined us, and I gave you the seven statements of the day, that God may be in some aspects perfect, but in others not perfect. He may be in some aspects all-knowing, but in others not perfectly able to know everything. But what Brightman's doing here, he's going to take the monotheistic concept of God. We have a perfect, all-knowing God, one that is ever-present, and combine it with a pantheistic God. And here's the advantage to this. When we think of an all-perfect, all-knowing God, concerning the problem of evil, we have something that takes place. If God is all-knowing, God is over here, he's all-knowing. And we're here in the world. He can see everything that's going to happen. How does God get around the problem of evil? He can foresee the future that's taking place down here. He's all-knowing, he's all-working, he's all-powerful. Why does God still allow gratuitous evil still exist in the world? That is evil that created evil, evil that seems to come possibly from God himself. And Brightman says we have to qualify our theistic concept of God up here. He's saying that there's something wrong with our concept or our definition of God that we hold here. When we say he's all perfect, all knowing, and all present, he's saying that he has a different concept of God. He just cannot believe that God would allow evil to operate on the plane of man without we're trying to do something about it. So what he's doing, he's taking the characteristics of deism and theism and combining them. Okay. He's saying that in the beginning, or pantheism, he's saying in the beginning God is up here. He creates the world. Okay. When he creates the world, it's something different than God's and his definition of God that allows for change on this level. Brightman says, according to the true nature of God, there are two different aspects. The first aspect is God's goodwill. And this is the dominant aspect of God. He sings God who creates the world as a goodwill. And through this goodwill, he intends for everything to be good in his creation. But Brightman also qualifies his definition of God by saying in this God up here, there's something that's passive in his nature. He calls it the given. He's saying there's something other in the nature of God that God himself cannot control. And he's saying that it's out of this that evil in the beginning exists. Okay, we have this God up here that has two different aspects of his nature. He creates man on this run. And by doing this, because of the problem in his nature, the problem of evil exists. Okay, how does he get around this? Why do we combine pantheism with a theistic concept? With a theistic concept, we have a God that's really, even though we can say that in our terms of monotheism, he does come to the world, he does participate with us, but this is very limited. But in pantheism, as we've noted, God is actually involved in the world process. He's in everything. So what Brightman's saying is this God out here that has a problem with his nature is really going to try to do something about the problem of people because of his goodwill. He's going to try to overcome it. So what he does, he chooses to make himself even more finite. He comes right to the level of man. He gets involved with man himself. He really makes himself, he even has the possibility of change because he accepts what man may be doing through his experience. In other words, as man changes in his experience at this level, Brightman is saying that God himself is willing to be changed by this. And by God coming to this level and working and suffering with man, eventually this goodwill which is dominant in his nature can overcome the problem of evil. Okay, you say, what are the advantages possibly of holiness? I'm not a positivist. I have to say myself, I'm not going to try to defend holiness position. But by being a positivist, you see that the problem of evil, even though he's saying the problem of evil comes from the nature of God, it shows God trying to do something about the problem of evil. It's not just an all-knowing being that's allowing the problem of evil to exist in the world. He's actually come to man's situation and he's trying to do this. Okay, this looks real nice. It looks like we're talking about quasi-theism that we have somebody that's really come up with a different God, a whole different God from what we see in our monotheistic faith, and he has. But why discuss this? I think there's an inherent weakness here. I think he's made God too finite. He's given man complete freedom, but in making God too finite, he has robbed God of the possibility of bringing something from beyond, from something outside of a finite situation to solve the world. That's a big problem. How can a God of goodwill still maintain his absolute goodwill and come from the level of absolute out here and get so involved in a finite situation here and be willing to change and still be able to overcome the problem of evil? This is the real weakness of what God can say. Okay, what about monotheism? Let's talk about a few characteristics of monotheism. We're much more in tune with this. I'm coming from an Orthodox Christian view of God, which most of us do, I think we can identify with this. And I think there's some inherent strengths here. I don't have to say I'm a monotheist, but I might be willing to modify some of my concepts, what it means for God to be all-knowing, all-perfect, all-present, by seeing some of these different views. Okay, what are some of the characteristics of monotheism? First of all, God is unique. He is secondly infinite. Thirdly, he's personal. Fourthly, he created everything other than himself. And this leads to the fifth statement. God is uncreated.
Awesome.
Uncreated. God, he creates everything up like that.
Would that be a theism?
In its extreme form, yes. That's your point. I think your point is an inherent weakness. Real good. But now the question I think the lady asked you yesterday concerning what Tillich had to say about absolute being may better clarify this. Tillich would say to merely talk about the existence of God itself, saying that God created man out of nothing, is to make God atheistic or form an atheistic concept of God. He he said really adhering to atheism to say that God created something out of anything. In other words, what you're saying is God was here, and some of the source gave him the nothingness out of which he created. Philip talks about continuous creation, in which God is constantly creating. Philip says he cannot perceive of the time when God was not in the process of creating. God is his creativity or being itself. I think, by clarifying here that God is uncreated, I think maybe we can get around to what you mentioned. Okay, number six, did that answer your question?
You said that God, he created everything, he was uncreated. And I asked him if he had a sin, he was showing as having an independent existence.
He does. But I think it's, you're right. But I think this is qualified in creativity. Sixthly, God is eternal. Seventh, God is omnipotent, all powerful. Eighth, God is omniscient, all knowing. Okay, number nine, God has the ability of attitude, both to express love and grace. Okay, now we've mentioned these characteristics. I think this will probably answer the question that was asked last period. Can monotheism be a theistic concept of God? Yes, it is. But if we notice every one of these eight characteristics we've given here, go one step beyond just the definition of theism. In theism, we talk about it unifies. God. Okay, but what about the term perfect? The seven statements that I mentioned from Hodgson is the seven different possibilities of taking the term perfect and some rearrangement of saying that you have to qualify perfection. You can be partially perfect, you can be wholly perfect. And we can take the terms, all-knowing, all-present, and all-powerful. And we can take these, and we can talk about those as possibly being partially knowing, but yet all-powerful, and it can still be all-present. But if we'll take these other characteristics, which are characteristics of monotheism, I think it qualifies this. This gives us a much stricter view, a much stricter theistic concept. It qualifies what it means to be perfect. You notice it doesn't leave an opening at all. I think probably one of the only inherent openings was what you mentioned. It's the fact he's saying about perfect. He's saying we just can't say God is perfect. Perfect, if we do, we're going to find ourselves in a trap. We got to qualify what it means to be perfect. It means knowing what it means to be unique, infinite, personal, all-knowing, ever-present, ever-powerful. And it also means that God has the ability to express himself through love, grace. Okay, so we see that monotheism is a much stricter form for the argument of God. Okay, what about the two different types of argument we could have, or the two different formulations we could have for theistic argument? There are two. The first one is an a for priori argument. I'll try to write this and have a problem pronouncing. Try to spell it right. And all this means is, okay, I think you can see the word prior coming out of a priori argument. What it's saying, when we try to formulate a theistic concept of God, we go behind or before the actual experience we have. Being standing here that are having experience. What it's saying, we're on the level of experience here. Okay, what it's saying, we're going to go beyond just our level of experience. We're going to go to something prior to that. We're going to try to go back, according to Hegel, if you're familiar with Hegel's metaphysics, what he tries to do in his lowest category, what he tries to think of being, the original, is what is the smallest possible thought that I can have about being? It's the very first presence of being itself when it comes into my thought. But what we have here with this argument, we're even going beyond that. There's only been one real a priori argument that has been defended, and this comes from Descartes and Anselm. And what they're really saying is, out here when I start at the position of nothingness, I can only go from the position of nothingness, I go to something. The very first concept that I have of something being perfect. This is where I start. You see, when Dr. Hall gets to the point, he talks about the ontological argument for God, that this is really hard to defend, because you go beyond or you go behind the experience that you have. You try to reach for something that was before or beyond it. Okay, what about a second type of argument we have? This is an a posteriori argument. It's hard to read the maps too. Okay, we can see the term posterior from one of these islands, can't we? And I think about you. But now that's not really the whole thing. The reason I say that, my wife saw this last night. She was looking at this term, and my last name happens to be Weirdy. My wife looked at that, she said, well, I think of you. But the whole key here really is post, which means after. Post, which means it comes after. It means it comes after the existence of our thought. Okay, well, you don't exist in a stage of existence. Okay, I'm here in existence. I'm a conscious being. I have thoughts, I formulate ideas, I formulate concepts. So basically what this argument is saying is that I look at my, on the level of my existence, I look at my thoughts, my concepts, I look at my everyday experience, I look at my world, and I take from this the reasons why God might exist, and I formulate an argument. In other words, what we're saying here is what I see and what I experience, and from what I gain from this, or the concepts that I formulate, it's from these concepts that I formulate an argument for the existence of God. Now I just want to mention couple other things. What about formulating an argument of God? We know that we can formulate an argument about something and make it valid, but will this necessarily point to the fact that God exists? I'm going to use Randy here for an example. We're going to put it in the if-then clause of the logical argument. I'm going to say, if Randy exists, if Randy exists, and I can come up with any statement here, no matter how absurd it may be, I can say, if Randy exists, all people are good, okay? Okay, really to have a valid argument, all I've got to do then is go one step farther and say, okay, Randy exists. I'm going to this level and say, okay, Randy exists. Therefore, all people are good. Okay, formulating an argument for the existence of God, I have a problem here. Just to have an argument is valid doesn't really say anything about the definition that I hold God at all. Because it's very possible. And I know Randy does exist, I can see Randy right here, but I can use myself as a personal example. All people are not good. So this statement is definitely not true. What then if we formulate an argument in which the statements are true? formulate a, say, we formulate an argument here, we could say, okay, and if a box is square or okay, if an object is square, it has four equal sides. Okay, what if I say then I have an object that is square, I can say then I can imply that it has four equal sides. Okay, we have a true statement. But we can have a true statement about God. I can say that God is all perfect. I can make a comparison here. I can say, I could take this thing and transfer it to God and make a true statement, but is this far enough to take a belief or concept concerning God? No, it's not. We have to believe. We have to believe a statement in order to be true concerning God. We not only have to have a valid argument, we not only have to take a series of statements that are true, but we actually have to believe these. Okay. We can go back to the concept of quadrivism. Brightman had a pretty logical argument for the existence of God. In fact, in my notes, he logically and systematically sets up a logic for the existence of God. And it's valid. He has actually set it up where it's valid. And it contains truth statements about the existence of God. He actually can prove that they're true by making implications that follow the processes of reason. But on the other hand, all I have to do to say that this object or this definition doesn't appear to God is to say, look, I do not believe it, and this is the reason that I do not believe it. That means that any argument that you have for the existence of God has to transcend over into the level of actual belief itself. And this you're going to find with the ontological argument, with the teleological argument, which is probably the strongest argument for the existence of God, because it seems to be based right on the law of reason. I'll give you an example. When Paley talked about the teleological argument, he said, for instance, if I go out and I walk in the mirror for a day, he said, if I see what's actually taking place, he said, I come to the conclusion there has to be a reason for this process. A reason for this process is taking place. He said, I can see order in it. And he uses the example of a watch, how the parts of the watch work together to formulate the process. But I can say, okay, I buy this. I can see that this is really true. And he said, I can see all the statements here are true. But I have to go one step further. I can say, okay, they're true, but I have to go to the point, do I really believe this? I think this is something that's abstract, but it seems to come through in any class like this. Because when we usually talk about the negative terms of the existence of God, how can you tell by looking at your face? Okay. The lecture before, when I started mentioning some of the negative concepts of God, I could tell that some of you, in the very beginning, thought that I might be holding this position as my concept of God. I had this to happen in another class of the famous Facebook. I got a red, she looked at me, and I thought she was going to say, you're wrong. Well, what I'm saying is, please try to keep this in mind as you can actually work through each one of these processes. If you do this, it doesn't mean that if you're a monotheist and you adhere strictly to this, that you've got to give this concept up. But really, what you can do by looking at Brightman's concept, that of God, his idea of a finite God, you can see that there are possible weaknesses in the theory that you may hold. And you may find that then we're only dealing with the definition of God. It's like I told you before. We're talking about a definition on this level, but we're finite. In actuality, I think all of us believe that God really exists, even though we can't be really. We believe that God exists up here. So what we have to do is be willing to admit there may be a problem with the definition itself. It may be the fact that, and even with a monotheistic concept of God, it may be the very best concept possible, but because of our finite ability to deal with this concept, we can't come to the true nature of what it's saying. Because we qualify the word perfect here. I think the monotheistic concept of God really qualifies the concept to be perfect as far as you can possibly take it. But because of the finite terms and the finite language we use, it leaves the argument itself open for the criticism, or for further thought, or to further questions. Okay, does anybody have anything they'd like to say at this time? Any questions? At all? If not, I'm going to let you rather. I promise that I'll be full time.